Terrorists seek headlines, and terrorism, of course, makes headlines. And for the past 2 or 3 weeks, our papers seem to have been filled with news, headline news, about terrorists and terrorism. We first read that a Lufthansa 707 plane had been hijacked on a flight between Mallorca and Frankfurt. Then we read that the terrorists demanded the release of members of the Baader-Meinhof gang who are imprisoned in Germany and of some Palestinian terrorists imprisoned in Turkey. We read that they shot the pilot of the plane and dumped his body on the tamarc in the airfield in South Yemen. We read of demands for ransom money as well as the jailed terrorists. We read of the surprise attack by the German commandos in Somalia, which freed the hostages on the plane and killed 3 of the 4 terrorists. We read that the body of a German industrialist, Martin Schleyer, who had been kidnapped some time before by members of the German gang, had been found in trunk Germany, killed. We read the news that 3 of the terrorists who were in jail, whose ransom had been demanded, were found as suicides. We read of their funeral, attended by black-hooded colleagues. Finally, we read in recent days of the kidnapping of a Dutch Jewish industrialist by someone who, at least over the phone, claims to be a member of this gang. Now, the word terrorism or terrorist comes from the Latin terrere, a verb which means to frighten. And certainly many have been frightened by the outburst of violence, of terrorism, which has made the headlines and moved through so many of the cities of Western Europe. The New York Times last week broke its usual style of reserve and inset a long story about the new terrorism, within a line drawing, which I'm sure many of you saw, a full-page line drawing of a dark forest with a group of black-hooded bats rising out of a cave in the distance coming at you, out of the shadows. The whole was black and frightening and foreboding. An old man told me once that you cannot eliminate the dangers of life, but you can eliminate fear from life. Now, what I'd like to do this morning is to try and bring the bats out of the forest, to look at terrorism as clearly as one can, to see what we can know about it and understand of it, because it is part of our lives, and I'm afraid will be part of our lives for a good long time to come. The first thing to know about terrorism, I believe, is that the bats, the black-hooded bats, the terrorists, have been with us since time immemorial. Terrorism has been known in every continent and in every age. It's not a new phenomenon. William Tell shot not only the arrow that pierced the apple on his son's head, but he shot out of the forest at a whole succession of Austrian bailiffs and sheriffs and taskmasters. In the 11th century, the major stream in Islam, which we call Ismailiyya, spawned a group known as the Assassins, who for 3 centuries went throughout Persia and that part of the world, striking down with their daggers those whom the old man of the mountain had told them to assassinate, men whose attitudes towards the true faith or whose willingness to compromise with the Seljuk Sultan was deemed inimical to the old man of the mountain's interests. When the English took over India, they discovered in southern India a group known as the Faqih, who sacrificed people to the death goddess Kali. And these people were chosen at random. You might be walking along a street in Madras and suddenly the dagger would come through someone's coat and you would be a sacrificial victim to the goddess. Incidentally, or perhaps not incidentally, our English word thug comes from this Indian sect. Terrorism is an old phenomenon. as old as history. Because power is coercive. Some power is more coercive and some less, but power is always coercive. And those who have power always abuse others below them, really, or at least in terms of their perception. And those who do not have power want the power, feel abused by power, and often have no other way but violence to gain it. There's always been terrorism from above and terrorism from below. There's always been the Gestapo, the NKVD, the Okhaga, and there's always been the bands below who by their daggers or swords or bombs are trying to destroy the secret police or destroy the state, the tyranny, which they represent. Terrorism is not a new phenomenon. Terrorism is a strange phenomenon because it is not simply, if we speak of terrorism from below, the act of those who are striking out against tyranny. Terrorism is always and inevitably a blend of motives, some political, some psychological, some pathological, some sociological. The terrorists are not God's noblemen, and some terrorists are not Satan, the devil incarnate. And terrorism is a complex phenomenon which cannot be reduced to a few simple, innocent statements. You may remember because we have been turned into a play and been one of the important symbols of the modern world, the terrorist attack by Charlotte Corday on the editor Marat, whom she stabbed in his tub in Paris during the French Revolution. Now, Charlotte Corday was a well-brought-up young woman. She was raised in a convent school. Her education was strict, narrow. She was a devoted member of her church. She was a model student in her school. She struck down Marat because she struck for God, because she had divided in her own mind the world into those who served God, whose ideas were like unto herself, and those who served the devil, whose ideas were revolutionary, like Marat's. And one of the classic ways of separating terrorism from the random violence, which is so much a part of modern life, is to understand whether or not the person conceives that he is striking for God, that he is doing what must be done, that he's doing the right. Terrorists ever and always know themselves to be in the right. They have divided the world into two camps. There is the good camp, the white camp, those who agree with them, and there is the black camp, Satan's camp, the devil's camp, all others. And it is ever and always an act of virtue to strike for God, to strike for the right, to take vengeance upon the devil. The word terrorism or terrorist became popular in modern times during the French Revolution. You recall that after the Etat General was established and the monarchy was overthrown, there was a progressive movement in politics to more and more radical activity. And finally, the extreme left group, the Jacobins, came into power. The Jacobins were determined to purge France of the past, and they were determined to stimulate the masses, to bring the power of the people to consciousness, so they would become active and exert themselves on behalf of the new world, and they kept the guillotine very busy, striking down and cutting off the heads of those who stood for repression or reaction or for the past. Robespierre, one of the leaders of the Jacobins during this terror, as it came to be called, and as it was called by the Jacobins themselves, said this, which is really the motto of all terrorists in one way or another. No means are criminal when they are employed towards a sacred end. No means are criminal when they're employed towards a sacred end. Now, terrorists believe that they are acting on behalf of some sacred end. And any means, however erratic, however violent, however patently criminal, is legitimate because it serves that end. Now, of course, there's the old saying, and it's a truism which to a certain degree is true, that those who live by the sword die by the sword, those who live by the bomb die by the bomb. Terrorism has rarely proved to be an effective weapon to achieve one's ends. Generally, terrorism ends only with a number of innocent people killed and with a terrorist killed. There is not a recorded instance, at least in modern history, where terrorism has overthrown tyranny and replaced it by a free society. The model of terrorism in the 19th century was that of the Russian anarchists, who in the 1870s and early 1880s struck out against the repressive autocracy, the tyranny of the Tsar. And they struck down the Governor General of St. Petersburg. They struck down the head of the hated secret police. Finally, they struck down the Tsar Alexander II. What did all of this anarchism produce? Not a free society on the Western model, which many of these terrorists claim to desire, but Bolshevism, a tyranny in its own way, as violent, as repressive, and as oligarchical as any that they had fought against. There is no instance in modern history in which tyranny has been overthrown by terrorism and been replaced by a free society. And there are a number of instances in modern history in which terrorists have struck at a fairly free society and overthrown it and ended up with tyranny. And the clearest example of that in recent times has been in Latin America, where typically the Tupamaros, the urban guerrillas of the Uruguay in the early 1960s, emerged to struggle against what they called a repressive society, but was in fact the oldest democracy in Latin America, a weak democracy to be sure, and moved that democracy to convulsions and repressions and finally succeeded in overthrowing it. And it was overthrown not by the left, but by the fascists, by the military junta. Terrorism, in this case, led directly to tyranny. Terrorism reminds me always of Samson, a strong biblical figure, strong but not very bright, who is chained finally towards the end of his life by the Philistines who have captured him in one of the temples of Dagon in Ashdod. He's chained to the columns of the temple, and he moves his hands with convulsive strength, and he finally succeeds in collapsing the columns and pulling down the roof of the temple on his head and the heads of whatever of his captors happened to be underneath. It's strong, deadly act, but it's an act which, of course, does not succeed in overthrowing the Philistines or achieving his end. It achieves suicide. And as a matter of fact, one of the psychological or psychiatric theories about terrorism, why people move towards terrorism, is that many are moved towards it because they seek suicide. They're afraid of killing themselves, they haven't the courage, and so they seek for some desperate way in which society will strike them down. Let me give you an example about terrorism from our own Jewish history. The Romans had a term called sicarii. It's a word which they used to describe highwaymen or armed robbers. The sica is a small curved knife which could be carried under the costume by the robbers and pulled out during the perpetration of whatever criminal act they were perpetrating. When the Jews rose in rebellion against Rome in the year 66 of this era, and after the rebellion was crushed around the year 70, the historian Josephus, a Jew, tried to explain to a Roman audience the events which led up to this rebellion. And he used the term sicarii to describe those bands of young Galileans and latterly of Judeans who had emerged in the early decades of the first century as assassins, as people determined to confront the Roman authority and to force the passive population of Judea who had accepted Roman rule because they couldn't do anything else, Rome was too powerful, to force them to rebel. And they did this from time to time by throwing stones at the Roman legions, by attacking a Roman officer who might be off wandering someplace through the marketplace alone, but more likely by attacking those more conservative Judeans who knew that rebellion against Rome was futile and who were trying as best they could to make their peace with the imperial society. And for 50 years before the rebellion of 66, the sicarii struck and struck again. They were mostly youthful gangs, and they helped to create the climate of opinion which finally led to the rebellion. Now, they weren't the only cause. Roman taxes were oppressive. Roman rule was venal and autocratic and cruel. Roman justice could be bought. There were many reasons for the rebellion, but certainly the sicarii contributed to it. And in gaining their rebellion, which they saw as an act of service to God, for Israel was to serve God alone and not some foreign master, they brought about one of the most critical defeats that Israel has ever suffered. 1 million Jews died in that rebellion. And another million died in the aftershock, in the rebellion of 132 of the Common Era. Where Jews had been a significant minority, some 20% of the Eastern Roman Empire before the year 66, after these two rebellions, they became the small minority that they have remained, a minority which now had to live largely on the tolerance and sufferance of others. And I've always believed that one could write Jewish history with this rebellion as the turning point. We were politically significant up to that point, and until modern times, we have reigned politically powerless and insignificant. And a long medieval history of suffering goes back, I think, to that origin. When I visit Matsada, I find I do not have that simple-minded exhilaration of in Jewish bravery that some say they find there. Oh, I know the story of the 3-year siege. I know the story of the suicide pact. But I can't help reminding myself that those who were on the top of Matsada were a Sicarii cell. The last remnants of this group of violent young Jewish terrorists who had plagued the Jewish community led to a rebellion and forced great tragedy. Terrorism is usually not the way. And even when terrorism is combined with one of the great mass movements of modern society, movements to remove from some country the hated colonial overlord, the movement to remove tyranny, as in the Soviet Union, the movement to avoid the confusions and convulsions of urban society that led to fascism in Europe in the 1920s. Even when terrorism is the cutting edge of one of these great mass movements, historians are questioned whether or not the actions of the Irgun, the actions of the IRA, the actions of the Hindustani Student Rebellion were in fact major contributory factors to the success of the freedom fighters, the majority who moved towards freedom or towards fascism or towards some other goal which the larger society seemed to want. In 1892, you may remember that a young man by the name of Alexander Berkman broke into the offices of Henry Clay Frick, who was then the chief operating officer of the Carnegie Corporation, and struck him down. And after this act, which was part of that whole series of attacks on industry and on the robber barons that led to the Haymarket Square riots, the lover of Alexander Berkman, Emma Goldman, went up and down this country explaining the reasons for this assassination. And she wrote this way, "The last desperate struggle of outraged and exasperated human nature for breathing space and life. We had no other alternative," she's saying. "These acts of violence are the last desperate struggle of outraged and exasperated human nature for breathing space and life." Now, I in no way defend the robber barons. Frick deserved probably what he got. But certainly, whatever this act was, it was not the last desperate struggle of the outraged and the exasperated. The struggle of labor in the United States was just beginning. This was the beginning of the stage, a stage which, has, as we have seen, has brought labor from triumph to triumph. What had happened, in a sense, is not that this is the frustrated idealist striking for God, because there is no other way to move the society. But what we have is a frustrated ideologue who has brought to America a system of thought which may have made sense in autocratic Russia, but made very little sense in a constitutionally based society such as our own. Berkman came to America 3 years before he struck Frick. He brought with him, as had Emma Goldman, the ideas of Bakunin, one of the Russian anarchists. In Russia, with the Okhara and the tyranny of the Tsar, there seemed to be no other way of forcing the hand of fate to move towards some other form of government than to strike at the government, at the people who represent it, to try and paralyze the government. Hopefully then something new would emerge out of Samson, pulling down the ceiling on the head of the society. But here in America, we have the vote, a democracy, regressive grievances, due process. There are all kinds and avenues of regress and of reform available to the laborer and to the worker. And it made no sense to act in this way. What I'm suggesting to you is this, that those who strike for God, terrorists, do so from a variety and a confusion of motives. They consider themselves as crusaders, but it is naive if we believe that by removing the cause which they proclaim as their own, we will have removed ourselves from the danger of future terrorism. Usually the things that terrorists demand are so sweeping or so vague or so incoherent that in any case they could not be resolved. And obviously we do not live in utopia and never will, so we will never have the workers' paradise or absolute freedom or whatever these claims may be. But in point of fact, terrorism is not simply the championing of a cause. The terrorists are crusaders. But I ask you to remember the crusaders of the Middle Ages. Who took up the cross? Not the saints of Europe, not God's holy men. Those who took up the cross were the second sons of relatively impecunious noblemen who had no prospects at home. Those who took up the cross were those who were under fine from the king, who had no other choice but to try and work out their destiny in another clime. Those who took off the cross were those who were adventurers, who loved violence. And England and France were relatively at peace for once. Those who took off the cross were those who hungered for spoil. Most of the crusaders never got to the Holy Land. They couldn't have cared less. They wanted the women of Athens and the gold of Constantinople, or the blood of the Jews who lived along the Rhine. Crusaders, though they proclaim a holy cause, are rarely, if ever, holy. They are people who have been moved by a whole variety of reasons, personal or social, who come out of an atmosphere which declares their cause to be holy and gives them a chance to sanctify their psychopathology, to declare as holy what they need to do and how much more satisfying it is when that, in fact, can be accomplished. Terrorism is a very difficult thing to get a hold of. Because though in the 19th century, terrorism and a variety of causes were fairly closely conjoined. The terrorists in India wanted England out. The terrorists in Israel wanted England out. The terrorists in Syria wanted France and Turkey out. And terrorists in Russia wanted the Tsar overthrown. Though it was fairly clear what some of these purposes were, and I would remind you that these purposes were not all noble. The early SS, the stormtroopers, the black shirts of Europe, were terrorists in the 1920s. And their goals were not the goals of freedom and of independence, but of fascism and Nazism. But there was a definable cause, and one could relate to that cause, and insofar as anything could be done about it, if one cared to do something about it, do it. But the new terrorism is increasingly unrelated to specific causes. The Baader-Meinhof gang, the so-called Red Army. The Red Army of Europe began by proclaiming itself as the champion of the working masses, the outraged and oppressed working masses of Germany. And the German laboring force is the best paid in the world. And they were not about to have a group of middle-class ex or semi-intellectuals become their proclaimed champions. They didn't need a revolution. They were enjoying the present. And when the workers didn't rise and the few bombs that were planted at Mercedes and elsewhere went off, killing a few workers but accomplishing little else, the Baader-Meinhof gang then proceeded to declare itself to be the champions, the warriors against war, to attack American imperialism because anti-Vietnam activity was popular throughout the world. And it was at that period that they planted bombs in the cars of American personnel stationed in Germany, and four were killed. And they went on a rampage of bank robbery, breaking and entering into American personnel's offices and in camp treasuries. And when the war was over and they hadn't made much contribution to the ending of the war, they then proclaimed themselves the agents of the oppressed people of Asia and Africa. And then they said, we are simply opposed to the government and the way of life, the amenity of life as it exists now in Germany. Now, what's their cause? Is it political? Is it social? How does one deal with these demands? And the answer, of course, is one cannot and one should not. These people are people who come out of the underworld of the university, where a certain set of ideas seethed and fomented, particularly in the late 1960s. Ideas about imperialist powers, ideas about the military-industrial complex, ideas about the repressive nature of all institutions, ideas about the lack of decency, the lack of life, of vitality in suburban culture, in middle-class Germany or middle-class America. And something, the word I guess one uses, is radicalized some of these young people. And they went underground. The Weathermen had their day of rage in the United States. In Germany, there were attacks on various military personnel and on the government. And finally, you have emerged these loose cells, these loose gangs of people who perform terrorist acts, acts which make the papers. Now, what do we know about these terrorists? We know that most who become terrorists when they're fairly young, in their late teens or early 20s. Terrorism is a phenomenon of youth. We know that terrorism in the 19th and 20th century has been terribly attractive to women. Women emerged in terrorism far earlier than they emerged in the larger society, and today it's estimated that 2 out of 3 terrorists are women. We know that terrorism becomes more and more violent as the terrorist moves further and further away from whatever seeming issue brought them into this underworld and finds himself caught up more and more in the activities of survival, financing what they do. We know that the modern terrorism tends to proclaim itself to be anarchic and freedom-loving. It has no compunction whatsoever in receiving training in the most autocratic societies in the world, in North Korea, Libya, Cuba, Iraq, nor in receiving arms from the autocracies of the world, from the Soviet Union, China, Uganda, countries of that ilk. One of the paradoxes of modern terrorism is that it operates only in the free world. And it operates most successfully with the societies most concerned with human rights and most concerned with the rights of individuals and most concerned with law. So we see terrorism operating paradoxically most effectively in West Germany, in England, to a certain degree in the United States, in those countries where this is the FBI and the CIA and the Sûreté Nationale and the other police forces are restrained from taking oppressive actions against them. Modern terrorism does not operate in the countries which are tyrannical. It operates in the free world. And it operates against societies where the worker and the underclass have opportunity and where there is a real concern that this opportunity be enlarged. It's for one of these reasons that people are finding it increasingly difficult to understand the causes which motivate the terrorist, because they're increasingly inchoate and vague. Modern terrorism is clearly an appeal by the young for attention. In the 1870s already, the terrorism proclaimed as one of its values that it was propaganda by deed, that terrorism always gets attention from the media. It's a way of calling attention to yourself or to your cause. And certainly in the 20th century, one of the first things that terrorists do are to call up the newspapers and to claim responsibility for this bombing or the like, or the next. And all of us, I'm afraid, are going to have to learn to demythologize the terrorist. America, the media, particularly in America, have been guilty of turning, you know, petty criminals into Bonnie and Clyde, turning people who are vicious and violent into folk heroes. And we're in the habit of looking to a certain degree on the terrorists as folk heroes. Not in looking at the psychopathology that moves them, at the cruelty, at the viciousness which is involved in what they do. But in looking at what seems to be a bit of courage, being moved by the cloak and dagger kind of operation that they engage in. We report on the terrorists as if it's a great adventure. And they become William Tell and Robin Hood, instead of people who are moved by deep pathological reasons very often to acts of incredible cruelty and violence. We're going to have to, all of us, recognize that these people are not heroic and that they are terribly dangerous to the social order. Not simply to social order, they're terribly dangerous to freedom. They're terribly dangerous to the rule of law. Because ultimately they become such a nuisance to the society that the society demands that they be put down. And then those who are in control of the society begin to use coercive measures to put them down, and these coercive measures become used against the society as a whole. Terrorism represents a cry for attention. It's the way in which the little person, without training, without power, can reach up and twist history, or think he's twisting history, make history conform to his or her will. There's a great love of adventure in modern terrorism. One of the terrorists was asked, or one of the colleagues of the terrorists was asked recently at this funeral of the three who committed suicide in the Stuttgart jail, why all of this furor? Wasn't Germany a prosperous and free society? And his answer was strange, but very revealing. He said to the reporter, our generation hasn't had its war. Terrorism is a cry for adventure. It's a way of having the juices flow, of being involved, of being caught up in doing something which is exciting. Now, how shall we relate to terrorism? Those who study this phenomenon, and there's become a whole subculture of terrorologists, I guess the word would be, those who study this phenomenon tell us that this particular Bader-Meinhof Palestine Liberation Front operation and all this flows from it is probably one of the last convulsive gasps of the terrorism of the 1960s and 1970s. They point to the fact that most of the terrorists involved are now approaching middle age. They began in the 1960s in their early 20s or late teens. They're now approaching their 30s. And at 30, if you haven't been able to make your way with a bomb, you give up using the bomb. Some of you may remember the lecture that James Wilson gave a year ago during our first Friday series when he talked about the rise of criminal activity in the United States. He said, one of the few things which we know for certain about crime is that after the age of 34, the percentage of any age cohort which is engaged in crime goes precipitously down. Only the so-called professional criminal remains in crime. And the terrorologists believe that this is true also of terror. That's the phenomenon of the Sturm und Drang, of the convulsions of youth. And that after a while, it loses its glamour. And experience begins to tell, and you realize that you're not going to make it this way. The world isn't going to change to fit your needs. And so they believe that this present rage of terror is subsiding. This is rather not the beginning of a new wave, but part of the aftershock of something that has been before. I don't know if they're right, and I don't know if they're wrong. Their position seems to make sense. I do know that this modern phenomenon of terrorism exists because there are governments who are willing to support it. Most of the terrorists in the Bader-Meinhof gang were trained in either North Korea or Iraq or in Cuba. Most of the terrorists in these gangs have received supplies from existing states. They've been able to use very sophisticated weapons, which have been carried to Europe for them in the diplomatic pouches of certain third world or communist or Arab states. One of the things that was generally overlooked in the press during the whole business with this Lufthansa plane was why the terrorists made for Somalia. And the answer is an interesting one. The plane which was hijacked on its way out of Israel that ended up in Entebbe was hijacked by a group from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which included German terrorists. Two German nationals were killed at Entebbe. And the operation was organized and supervised and administered by a man named Wasi Haddad, who is the operations officer of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine from Mogadishu in Somalia, with the encouragement and support of the Somali government. What was the difference between that raid and this raid? When they came, the terrorists came to what they thought would be sanctuary this time, they overlooked the fact that the Somalis have since become embroiled in a war in Ethiopia, and they had just made a major submission for arms of West Germany, and obviously it was not in their best interest to bruise West Germany with this kind of activity at this time. They made a fatal tactical mistake. But there have always been governments which have been willing to provide safe refuge for the hijacker. Algeria provided it for those who hijacked the Japanese airliner. There will be other governments, Amin's, Uganda. The governments may be fewer today, but it is true of the small governments of Africa. It is true of the Arab state governments. It may possibly even be true of France, because I remind you of the precipitous way in which France, despite its laws, released Abu Daoud a year ago, the terrorist who was involved in the Munich massacre. Terrorism exists because it gains support from national governments, which says something about the divisions of our world. And before we become too self-righteous about it, I wonder how we feel about the Vietnamese who hijacked a plane yesterday or the day before and brought it out through Thailand to Singapore. Will we return these people who have, quote, won their way to freedom, to Vietnam? I wonder. And yet along the way, they butchered two of the officers, the pilots of the plane. As long as there is this kind of international violence, that is, as long as governments are competing with each other in the way which we do today, so long will the terrorists be able to hide in the interstices of these quarrels and find support by governments who think they can be used or are useful for other reasons. And these governments have provided, in some cases, very sophisticated weapons to the terrorists. The terrorists, they found two terrorists a year ago outside one of the airports in Rome who had ground air missiles prepared to shoot at an El Al plane. And when the report came out in our papers a year ago, a young graduate student in physics at Princeton had assembled all the equipment needed to make an atomic bomb from private sources and was technically prepared to do so, one could read, without reading the stars, that some bright young student in the future attached to one of these movements would do what the explosive experts of the 1880s had done for the anarchists in Russia and assemble a bomb for one of the terrorist groups. And then how do we stand up to terrorist extortion? Clearly, the governments of the world need to stand up to terrorism and need to capture the terrorists, and perhaps some of the governments need to rethink the whole movement away from capital punishment, because it's almost impossible to keep the terrorists for any length of time in jail. It only stimulates action by their colleagues to release them. Perhaps there has to be a catalog of crimes which speak of, you know, multiple kidnappings and multiple murders and prescribes the capital punishment for that. But whatever the reason, whatever we take as our means of handling terrorism, let us recognize these people for what they are, a danger to freedom, despite the fact that many of them proclaim their allegiance to freedom, a danger to civilization, despite the fact that many of them draw about themselves one cause or another. A few, just a few. Most of these gangs number 20 or 30 or 40 young people, and that's the whole of it. We need to find the ways of capturing them, rendering them impotent, jailing them. We need to find an international order which will prevent their using us, the nations of the world, for their own specific purposes. Because I'm afraid if we don't, it will not be long before, instead of throwing bombs or planting bombs, instead of even having ground-to-air missiles, they will avail themselves of germ warfare, with the atomic bomb, and then society is going to have some very terrible and terrifying decisions to make. We live, my friends, as I've said to you time and again, not in the most perfect of worlds, nor in a world which is ultimately perfectible, but in a world which has its share of tsaros. And the terrorists are one of our tsaros. And we're going to have to handle them with all the intelligence that we can. And we have to recognize that even in the best of societies, we will not have eliminated terrorism. Indeed, that terrorism tends to spawn precisely in the societies which are the most open and the most prosperous and the most concerned with the rule of law. If you ever move to pray, terrorism will move you to your knees. Amen.